The next case is 09-1171, Toledo Bar Association versus John G. Rust. Mr. Kerger.
Please, the court. Morning, Your Honors. I'm here on behalf of John Rust, and I know Justice Lanzinger is familiar with John. I'd like to make one personal observation before I begin. It is refreshing to note that notwithstanding the passage of 40 years and the expenditures, what no doubt is hundreds of millions of dollars, the morning commute in Columbus is just as bad as it was when I went to school here. The proposition I'm putting before you is fairly simple. A lawyer took action based on legal precedent, which he felt allowed him to do as he did, and that legal precedent, when presented to the panel, was found by the panel to constitute an argument worthy of consideration. Their language, not mine. And yet they then find an ethical violation. I'll accept certainly the fact that a panel of judges could decide that his argument was wrong about whether or not the titular status of the executrix or executor allowed him to do what he did. But I don't see how you can posit an ethical violation on conduct that the panel said was based on an argument worthy of consideration. That's what happened here. I will say, if you find this to be a violation, we don't challenge sanction that the board has imposed. I just think in this case, the fellow comes into his office less than a week before the statute is going to run, the one-year renewal period. That's a very short time to investigate the case. John did what he did. He filed the action. Because if he doesn't, what he does know is that's gone. Now, to be sure, he could have gone to the probate court and filed an action to replace the executor. But I don't think that would have told any statute. To preserve the action, he still would have had to file it, and he could only file it in the name of the person that had the legal cause of action, the executor. So it might be you could criticize him for not filing the probate action sooner. But at the end of the day, in order to preserve his client's rights, I think he had to do what he did. Most of the cases you have here involve lawyers who neglect their clients.
So let me back you up one step. You said if we do find there's a violation, your client does not quarrel with the sanction?
Correct.
All right. So that leaves us then just to focus on whether or not there's a violation.
That's the limit of our...
And what do we know? It's an interesting and colorful recitation by the panel of this matter. What do we know about this? Was the second executor? Is that?
As I have the facts, there was an executor appointed. She determined that since the possibility of an action against the nursing home existed,
she had a conflict.
Her firm did work for the nursing home, and she had to withdraw.
And then the second executor, these are chosen by the probate judge.
Correct.
Is that what happens, that the family doesn't get any input in the selection of the executor?
You don't have the record before you. My understanding that was the practice that occurred in this case.
So this is the hand-picked executor named by the probate judge without any suggestion or input at all from the family.
I would adopt. I say yes to your answer with this caveat. I certainly don't think there was anything improper in the judge's selection.
And if there was a legitimate malpractice case, the executor is not the beneficiary of a good outcome at all.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's my understanding.
The person who saw Mr. Rust is would be the beneficiary of a good outcome.
Mr. Tillman, the son of the decedent.
Okay. Now, here's a potential rub in all of this. I mean, so far, if you take that scenario along and you've got limited time, I can see his point of view. I've got to protect the statute of limitations. I've got an executor that the judge isn't going to take off and filing an action. I'm not going to have time to get that even accomplished. So that dilemma. But doesn't the executor control who gets to be the plaintiff's attorney?
I think the executor would.
Okay, so is the possible motivation for a violation? I want this piece of business, and I don't want some lawyer that the executor chooses.
I don't think this piece of business. I don't think so, because twice, according to the panel's findings, the executor rejected the institution of suit. The suit was filed once before, which is why we got into the 1 year.
And this executor rejected that?
Yes. Doing so without an investigation. The findings of the panel were, and not challenged, are that he did not conduct any investigation until after he wrote the second letter asking that the suit be dismissed. I mean, the panel's findings, in this paragraph 21, unfortunately it appears that everyone involved, the trial judge, the estate administrator, was looking for a shortcut in dealing with this case. As a result, respondent simply ran out of time and alternatives.
Okay, can you state, in your professional opinion, had Mr. Rust gone to the probate court and had the probate judge been receptive, is there a procedure whereby the probate judge can take the executor off summarily without a hearing?
I doubt that. I think there would always have to be hearing and a notice.
And hence the time runs.
That's my understanding, yes, Your Honor.
Are you sure of that?
I'm not sure of it. That's my understanding based on the limited research I did in that area and what happened afterward. I don't think it's in this record, but there was subsequently a hearing in probate court, which I believe is now on appeal, stayed by the bankruptcy filing of Duane Tillman, the son of the decedent.
Mr. Kerger, the concern I have, there were six original charges brought, and only one did the panel find evidence to sustain, being shall not represent a client where the representation will result in a violation of the rules. And in 1996, there was an earlier charge, a sanction for representing competing interests. The real question, though, we know that Mr. Rust is 92, and the real question about competence or ability to maintain an active practice is the concern here, or I think the underlying concern. Now, you had a request, or someone had a request for a mental examination that was unsatisfactory, is that correct?
It was satisfactory from our standpoint. It did not support what the Toledo Bar had thought it would. The evaluation by Dr. Chaudhry, and I'll read you his conclusion, because they didn't cite all of it. It is my conclusion that Mr. Russ's first and foremost handicap is that he has deafness. It is my opinion based on that fact that his hearing is impaired. His critical judgment is also impaired. In short, he didn't hear so well. And he's going to be 94 in a couple of weeks, and I'm not surprised at that. He does have hearing aids. But it's the absence of ability to hear clearly that affects his critical reasoning, not dementia. He was given a test, and this is in the record and the evidence, by the doctor, and 30 was a perfect score. He scored 29. I don't have a certificate that say I'm competent. He does. And so that's why, and Your Honor, you're quite correct. That is the underlying concern that has run through this whole case. The fellow's 93 years old. Well, I read a story in the newspaper a couple weeks ago. There's a guy in Texas who's 101 and practices law every day, 6 days a week. I don't think, and I can't imagine this court would say that there's an age barrier or that deafness makes you unfit to be a lawyer.
Although we have an age barrier for the judiciary, and we don't, to my knowledge, for practicing lawyers, correct?
We don't, and I would say I'm not all that crazy about age barriers for judges, but it does create a large cadre of wonderful visiting judges and senior judges can help out with the docket.
I'm not as concerned about his age, I guess, as I'm about the relators pointing out some of the things that the relator believes the board missed. On page 4 and 5 of the relator's brief, as you know, there's a this problem with Mr. Russ representing a client he didn't have in filing the suit. And I think you probably sort of responded to that already, but let me hear your response again and succinctly if you can. A 30-year-old lawyer could be accused of that, I mean, that's not an age-related issue, I don't think, is it?
That's quite correct. I think that what makes this unique is not his age, it's the circumstances. The visit by the client a short time beforehand, he has the history from the client that the fella doesn't want to file the lawsuit. It is, to use the terms of other legal actions, it would be a vain effort for him to ask the present executor to file the suit. He knows he's turned it down once already because he copied the complaint from Elk and Elk when he filed it. And so in those circumstances, he then within a month moved to have a new executor appointed, and Judge Franks granted it.
Right.
And so there was a deficiency at the time he filed that within 45 days was corrected. Again, I can certainly understand, Justice Moyer, that a panel of judges or a judge would say, no, that's not right. You didn't have authority, it's not timely, and dismiss the whole action. But I don't think, with the precedent he had from this court about the titular nature of the executor's and administrator's role, that what he did was unethical. And that's the gravamen of the offense. And I would say that whether the lawyer was 30 or 90.
So your argument seems to me to be that, as a general premise, certainly a lawyer should not file an action on behalf of someone who is not his client, his or her client, but the circumstances in this case should cause us to carve out an exception or at least not apply that general rule.
That's precisely, I would observe this, and it's an argument I told Mr. Cherry I wasn't going to make and I won't make it, but if you read the rules, I'm not aware of anything in there.
I'm not aware
of anything in there that says a lawyer can't file on behalf of somebody he doesn't represent. It says he can't settle cases, there's other things, but there's no clear rule that says you gotta have the authorization of the client to file the suit.
But counsel, did he even attempt to contact the appropriate entity to file the suit?
No, and the reason he didn't, Your Honor, is that he knew that this person had previously ordered a lawyer to dismiss the action. He didn't want the malpractice case brought.
He knew that how?
His client came in with the complaint and the whole
exactly.
story.
Exactly, and if every lawyer relied on everything without ascertaining the truth of the representations by simply a professional courtesy to, I'm looking at paragraph 12, I guess it is, of the findings of fact and conclusions of law, and page 12 says, following the dismissal, the claim remained dormant until Mr. Tillman appeared at his office about a week to 10 days, to go, small window of time, apparently concluded from Taylor's prior conduct that the administrator was not going to cooperate. There was no, representation that he even attempted to ascertain that, to do any kind of professional activity to, number one, verify what his client was telling him, and number two, maybe get a explanation from the appropriate parties here to this action as to why that wouldn't have been appropriate.
First, you're correct without question. He made no effort to contact the executives. That's true. The executor. What I do know is, though, that the file was brought to him.
Pardon me?
The previously filed case was brought to him with the letter from the administrator saying, dismiss this case. I don't want to bring it. I don't know that relying on that letter written by the administrator is an ethical breach. It certainly would have been the better form to call and tell them what you're doing, but I think the assumption would be he's going to say, no, don't do it. And then the statute's blown. I think I've...
I think, just to make sure I can, in the record, this all occurred, this activity occurred before Mr. Tillman was found to be a vexatious litigator. Is that right? It was sometime after that.
I think he had been found to be a vexatious, either the action, I'll have to rely before, on my learned brother's recollection. I think he had been found to be so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kerger. Mr. Cherry.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Cherry. I'm here on behalf of the Toledo Bar Association. Initially, I'd like to clear up perhaps a couple of questions that were asked of Mr. Kerger. Specifically, the vexatious litigator order occurred in late June, early July of 2007. I may have the year wrong, but it was after this lawsuit was filed. What happened in the probate proceeding was that there was a dispute early on between an attorney named Edward Fisher, and Dwayne Tillman, both of whom applied to be the executor of this lady's estate. And the probate court chose a third-party attorney, a neutral in this dispute, a lady named Sarah McHugh. And when it became clear that there might be some litigation against the nursing home where the lady had resided, Ms. McHugh discovered that there was a conflict, and she already represented some interest involving this nursing home. So she resigned, and the court chose Douglas Taylor to be the subsequent fiduciary. Administrator DBN with Will and Next, I think, was the official title.
And there was a statement, I'm not sure it's accurate, I'm not sure I understood it right, that after this suit was filed by Mr. Rust, that he did make application to substitute a new administrator and a third administrator was put in? Is that correct, or is that, did I have that wrong?
He did that about 4 months after the suit was filed.
And was a new administrator put in?
No.
No? So the same administrator stayed on the estate, the one that had rejected the claim originally, or rejected the lawsuit?
Yes, Your Honor, and to my best of my knowledge, still serves today.
And what happened to the lawsuit that was filed?
It was dismissed on a 12B6 motion.
For what reason?
I believe the notion being that it was not brought on behalf of the proper party.
And then the time had run.
Yes.
Okay. So, if a lawyer other than Mr. Rust, let's lay this age issue to the side, because I'm certainly not interested in that. If a lawyer other than Mr. Rust, did Mr. Tillman come into his office with this pile of papers? Is there any way to protect the statute of limitations from running without doing exactly what Mr. Rust did, and that is file the case to protect the statute without the consent of the administrator?
The answer is I think there is a way to do that. And to avoid a violation of the rules of professional conduct.
And how would you do that?
I would suggest that the lawsuit have been filed in the name of Tillman, the heir and the fellow who is the actual client of Mr. Rust, and then using the rationale in the Douglas case, ask the probate court to substitute him as a subsequent administrator or fiduciary of the estate, and that could relate back to the filing of the lawsuit under the Douglas case. What we had here, however, was a situation where Rust files a lawsuit purportedly on behalf of Taylor when he not only didn't represent Taylor, he'd never met Taylor and knew perfectly well that Taylor was opposed to the filing of that lawsuit.
But the wrongful death statute says it has to be brought in the name of the fiduciary of the estate, doesn't it?
Correct. But
so you would posit that he could avoid getting this case thrown out on a 12b-6 by not bringing it in the name of the person the statute requires?
I would posit that, given the rationale in the Douglas case.
So perhaps Mr. Russ was not aware of the Douglas case when he did this. And if he wasn't, wouldn't that be malpractice rather than an ethical violation?
If he were not aware of the
Douglas case. He's looking at the statute. It says you got to file it in the name of the administrator. He knows the administrator is uncooperative. So he files it, and then his strategy is, I'm going to try and get this guy removed, explain to the probate judge, he's killing the potentially good lawsuit. He files it in a timely fashion. He's unaware of the case that you're citing, and my question is, isn't that malpractice instead of an ethical violation?
He was unaware of. I think it's an ethical violation when you file a lawsuit on behalf of someone who is not your client.
But it's not an ethical violation to file it when you know the statute doesn't allow you to?
At least it's out in front, and you're making a statement to the court that you're not making a false statement to the court in the world that you represent this person.
But you're really running a high risk that gets tossed because you haven't followed the statute, and the time's up by the time that question gets to the judge.
You are running a high risk of that.
Well, counsel, were there any other siblings besides Mr. Tillman who would have been beneficiaries of a wrongful death here?
To the best of my knowledge, Mr. Tillman was the only potential beneficiary if this lawsuit had been successful.
So his foot dragging, for want of a better word, letting the statute get to the brink here of a week or 10 days before it expired, and then coming to Mr. Russ to say, you need to do something here for me. Sometimes there's things that attorneys just can't fix, based on
sure.
And what
in fact happened in this case was a first lawsuit was filed in the name of Taylor by another attorney.
Right.
Taylor said, I don't know anything about this. I want the case gone.
Was that attorney prosecuted for an ethical violation?
No.
Why not?
Because in that case, given an opportunity to repair the damage, he did it.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
He dismissed the lawsuit.
Well, so it's not the filing in the administrator's name that's the ethical violation. It's his failure to then dismiss it?
Well, there was also an issue that isn't in the record, frankly, but we looked into that, and the first executor of the estate advised us in the course of our investigation that she could not recall whether she authorized this lawsuit or not.
Did the attorney represent that he was authorized by the executor to do it?
He filed it in the name of the executor.
So you don't prosecute him because you're not, she's not sure she said yes or no. Was he interviewed and asked if she said yes or no?
I don't believe so.
And you don't pursue that, but you pursue Russ?
We did. After the first lawsuit was filed and Taylor found out about it, he instructed it be dismissed, and it was dismissed. A year then goes by, and at that time, the record will indicate that he instructed Tillman that if you have evidence of the validity of a wrongful death claim, bring it to me and I'll evaluate this.
Who said that?
Taylor said that.
The executor?
Yes.
Okay.
Your Honor. He testified that he said, look, I'm not going to put my name on a lawsuit if there's nothing to it, but if you have evidence, bring it to me and we'll consider this.
Does he have any obligation as an executor to conduct an investigation on behalf of the beneficiary since he's the party that's supposed to file the lawsuit?
I think he probably has some obligation to
at least... Did the first attorney file this lawsuit in bad faith with no basis?
I don't know.
But there's no... I mean, the opinion seems to say that the executor didn't do any investigation and didn't follow up.
Your Honor, I think there's a question as to what level of investigation is required of the executor. In this case, he had the beneficiary, who was also rapidly in the process of becoming a vexatious litigator, telling him, I've got this claim and you file it, or I'll file it in your name, and the executor said, give me some evidence.
But let's back up to the Elk and Elk filed lawsuit.
Yes, sir.
You said Taylor instructed Elk and Elk to dismiss it?
Yes.
And what was the basis for that?
That his name, Taylor's name, had been substituted on as a plaintiff on that lawsuit. He was not aware of the validity or basis or the evidence for pursuing that lawsuit.
So he did conduct some investigation to determine that there was no basis for the lawsuit.
He became aware that he didn't have any evidence. He wasn't aware that no evidence existed. And he said to Tilleman, give me some evidence.
Did he ask Elk and Elk what evidence they had when they filed the lawsuit with their name on it? Under Rule 11?
I don't know what evidence they may have had. They did file a lawsuit, and it did not get far enough to be faced with a Rule 11 challenge, or to the best of my knowledge, whether any... responsive pleading was filed. I don't know. I would like to point out one thing. In the report of Dr. Chowdhury, we had Mr. Rust examined by a physician at our request, which was not opposed by the respondent. And his reports are an exhibit in the panel hearing, and he says, my final conclusion is that Mr. John G. Rust has a mild to moderate cognitive disorder in which his critical judgment is impaired. Based on my above close observation, it is my opinion that he should not engage in the practice of law at this time.
So you do want to age him out because he can't hear. Is that the bottom line?
It's not because he cannot hear, and it's not because he's old. It is because he's suffering a mild to moderate cognitive disorder affecting his ability to practice law.
But when you hear the rest of it, isn't that report based on the fact he can't hear? Isn't that the cognitive disorder? If you can't hear, you can't understand.
I don't believe that the report bears that out, Your Honor.
Okay.
So that's one of his problems, is that he can't hear, and therefore... that impairs his abilities, but the report also finds the condition that produces mild cognitive dysfunction, which is not just based on a loss of hearing. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Your Honor. In summary, we would ask that the board's report be accepted by the court and that Mr. Rust be found to have violated the rules of professional conduct and that he be sanctioned appropriately. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cherry. Mr. Kerger, 30 seconds for summation.
The sentence right in front of the one that he read from Dr. Chowdhury says, It is my opinion that based on the fact that his hearing is impaired, his critical judgment is also impaired. That's what the doctor said. Number two, and this is to clarify a point, I think John may have misunderstood the question. The complaint was filed on March 29th. The motion to replace the executor was filed on April 24th. These are both exhibits. Months later, after Judge Franks rescinded her order replacing the executor, 4 months later he went to probate court to seek removal. But he hadn't done it earlier because he'd gotten it replaced by the Court of Common Pleas and didn't know he needed to do anything else.
The underlying lawsuit, whatever its merit, is lost at this point. It's gone.
I'm not sure because there are two different appeals, and I believe that that issue is still on appeal, stayed because of the bankruptcy of Mr. Tilleman.
Okay.
That's all I have. Thank you,
Mr. Kerger. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Mm-hmm.